This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Darius Rejali. He's a professor of political science at Reed College in Oregon and is one of the world's leading experts on torture. I spoke with him on May 15th, 2009, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in Portland, Oregon. This interview is included in our program, The Long Shadow of Torture. Download the MP3 of that produced show at speakingoffaith.org.
Well, thank you. And likewise, what's the weather like over there?
I don't know. It's kind of trying to become summery, but it's cold in the mornings. But the sun is shining. My flowers are growing.
Oh, yeah. What season? Is it bulbs or is it something
I've
else?
I've got tulips and I bought a new house last summer and I don't know everything that's in my garden, but the person there who was there before me did a beautiful job in planting perennials. So
oh, I understand that problem. Gift, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
When I bought my house, I bought it in the fall. I had no idea what was going to spring up. I wasn't planning on
I moved in August, and a lot of things in Minnesota were already dead by then. So.
And then you're compelled to be a gardener.
Exactly. But I have a much better beginning. It's a more promising beginning than,
than if I had started from
scratch.
Anyway, so.
Yeah. Well, I want you to say your name for me just so I. Darius. And then how do you say
Darius
your last name?
Rejali.
You do say Rejali. Okay.
I do.
All right.
I do.
Is that really the Iranian way?
No, of course not.
No. Wouldn't it be the more Iranian, like Rejali or something like that?
Right. My full name would be Darius Rejali.
All right.
Right, exactly.
All right. But, I won't try that.
Yeah, no, it's my mother gave me Janus face names so that they'd work in both cultures. Mm-hmm. And I suppose a lot of people say Darius.
Right.
But that's just the French pronunciation. British Indian pronounce it Darius.
Okay. So. Well, I think it's noble that you hung on to that pronunciation all these years.
It was trained onto me in the schoolyard. There were so many other Dariuses. I had to be different.
Right.
You can't. It's a very common name in Iran when I was growing up.
Okay. So. Well, do you know the show, Speaking of Faith?
Here's what happened. When your invitation came, uh-huh. I immediately spoke to a couple people, and they were like, yeah, I listen to it every week. And so then they filled me in.
Okay.
So I feel like – they said it's sort of like a NPR show, but it's not an NPR show. It's sort of – I don't know. How would you describe it?
How would I describe it? Well,
yeah,
I think the title it works against us a bit. I mean, we call it Public Radio's program about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. The truth is we're doing big, deep, in-depth discussion that you couldn't do anywhere but public radio.
Right.
But we're having conversations that no one's having anywhere else, including on public radio. So,
right.
I think you are perfect. You're the perfect – what I'd like to say is that I like to speak at this intersection of big ideas and human experience of real life. And, the fact that you bring all these experiences together in your person as well as this vast scholarly knowledge is really exciting to me. So,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope I can deliver. It's in there. It's pulling it out is sometimes complicated.
All right. Well, I'm pretty good at that. That's my job. And so, I think that when Colleen wrote to you, as I watch this torture, I don't even think there's much of a debate going on yet. Whatever it is, this confrontation with reality. I keep thinking of this great line of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, in a democracy, some are guilty while all are responsible. And then that's the conversation I'd like to provide some fodder for. You know, what is the shared responsibility and our shared consequences? And I think you know that. I don't know. Those are the questions you get asked.
I don't often get asked questions about that because, as you can imagine, most people are interested in the minutiae of, did Pelosi know? Does torture work?
Mm-hmm.
the sort of grand questions of, I guess I would call it, I mean, for me, would be passive injustice. You know, it's the, we are all doing our job as citizens, and, you know, how responsible can we be?
Mm-hmm.
And, but I also kind of, I'm happy to talk about that. We can explore all that, sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I cannot say I have read every word of your book because some of it's hard to read, and because I'm liberated by the fact that I don't want to get into some of that granular stuff. But I have spent time with your book, and I've read a lot of other interviews you've given and pieces you've written. And here's what I want to say also. We're going to produce this a couple of weeks from now. And also, I want to produce something that we might put on the air next month and again next year, because I don't think this subject is going to go away. So let's not be tied too much to what happened yesterday or what might happen tomorrow. I mean,
wow,
you know, we may.
It's like I'm in shock.
Yeah. Well, you know what? So I mean, the photos, the question of whether the photos will be released.
I mean,
I think we can talk about the photos and what they might mean, but not necessarily be too tied to the news cycle. So let's just try it. And we, you know, of course, we will end up talking about things that are happening yesterday or tomorrow, and that's all right. But it may not make its way into the show, or we might produce the show and edited a little bit different way a year from now. So anyway.
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, many of the things that are happening today are just examples. I mean,
right,
used for any number of situations.
Right.
So
right.
It's not hard to weave them together with broader themes.
Okay. So
yes. I'm sorry. We got someone in here.
Back off just about.
I need to back off.
There you go. Right about there.
Am I good? There. All right.
Okay.
So I'm told. So I'm not going to move from this spot. And there's a cat in the room. Does the cat
there's
really matter?
There's a cat in the room?
There's a lovely Siamese cat in the room, or some cross.
Not even supposed to be there.
Well, does the cat know to be really quiet?
No, the cat just left.
I have to say that's a new one. We've never had a cat in the room. We've had all kinds of other things going on.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
So let's start. And again, we do get to have a real conversation. We will edit this down later on, so you can expound on things, and it doesn't even have to be linear.
Right.
Where
and I can restart if
you
I'm
can restart, too, but let's, don't worry about see. Don't worry about if you. I mean, I can. We can make you sound digital. We could all use digital editing in our life. So.
All right. Yes. True.
What I want to say is, where I start with every interview, whether I'm interviewing a quantum physicist or a theologian or whatever, is I'd like to just hear, and I know something about this from your work, but talk to me about how you would describe the religious and spiritual background of your life, of your childhood.
Well, I was born in an Iranian-American family. My mother's American, Protestant background, and my father's Iranian, Shiite in background. I guess I would say I grew up most of my life in my teenage years in Iran, and at the age of seven, my mother decided to send me to community school, which was a former Presbyterian mission school and carried much of the Presbyterian ethos with it. So we went to chapel, but at the same time I knew I was a Muslim. It kind of was part of growing up as a child. It's like I realized I wasn't Christian. Hmm. But yet I absorbed all these sort of Protestant attitudes, I guess I would say, about, you know, work for sure. But I always, I mean, I think that...
So that's the Calvinist side of you, the work
that's
ethic?
That's the Calvinist side, the side that really can't, you know, has its sort of conscience that drives one to constantly push.
All right.
The Shiite side, I would say, is a real sort of concern for justice and mercy. And when I think about sort of fundamental attitudes towards life, that's one thing that I associate pretty strongly with my Muslim background, which is a sort of sense of the righteousness of things. My mother felt very strongly that I should start off with a strong religious foundation no matter what other decisions I made in life, just so that I could know the distinction between good and evil. And as it turns out, you know, she sent my sister to a Catholic school many years later. So she was rather agnostic about how we started, just as long as we had that distinction firmly in our mind. The other thing I should say as part of sort of my ethical raising background is that, you know, one of the things I particularly liked about my childhood was my mother brought back from the from Russia old communist cartoons, which were wonderful because, you know, the communist cartoons are all about working together with other people. And they kind of teach a sort of ethical value of cooperation and kindness towards others. So it was a rather mixed ethical bag that I inherited.
Right. And you've said that in terms that you wouldn't have believed when you were growing up if someone told you you'd one day write not one but two books about torture.
Yeah.
And yet torture was it was a reality that you knew about. It was a fact of life in the air you breathed culturally and even in your own family history.
Oh, yeah. No, that's certainly true. It kept on seeping back in. I think, you know, when I think back on my childhood, I think of a history class where it was mandatory that all Iranians had to take Persian history, and there was no exception for me, even though I was in an international school. And we were taught about the old kings and how unjust they were. And this was always ended with praise of the monarchy, the Shah at the time.
Right.
And one of the famous incidents that they describe is a case of a king who walked into a rebel city about 200 years ago. And he ordered a series of brutal punishments, including removing the eyes of about 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. And everybody, of course, was horrified. And, you know, as you can imagine, kids talk about these things. For me, this was difficult in a different way because this was an ancient relative of mine. Mm-hmm. And so the puzzle that I went away from is, yeah, I knew that he was a cruel man. What I don't understand is why he needed eyes. Why couldn't he have just killed people or anything like that? So I guess the sociologist in me was born.
Right.
You know, I come from an old aristocratic family, you know, that was accustomed to power on my father's side. And they didn't exercise power always particularly in a noble or just way. And yet they had these great ideals of gentlemanliness and kindness and mercy. And there was always a deep tension in those values. So, yeah, that was part of my childhood. And then, of course, growing up in Iran at that time, you know, we all knew that there was a secret service. My father worked in the official opposition. And when the king dissolved the official opposition in 75, people disappeared. So there was a feeling that at all times you were being watched, that people disappeared. And yet there was the irony where when Time magazine did a big expose on torture in Iran, it was available for sale at the Hilton Hotel. And, you know, so there was these – everybody knew that bad things were happening and that these things weren't incompatible with modernization, with washing machines and dry cleaners.
Right.
And
I mean
–
and I think this is a point you make that's important to draw out, that you had a lovely childhood also in many ways, and that you were in fact living in a modern society, right? That the fact of torture merged with – it was a modern, educated, cultured world.
Yeah, I think that there's no question about that. I lived in a very modern world, well, I mean, relatively to many places. It wasn't like I was going to school on donkeys or something mm-hmm. like that. I you know, I had bus services and taxis and movie theaters, and there was even an ice rink that we went skating on. Mm-hmm. And you know, most people don't associate these things with Tehran, but Tehran was a very cosmopolitan city in the 70s, a very stable city, a bustling city. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess the connection between modernity and violence, you know, what it is to be modern and what kinds of things that precludes was always a problem. I think this really got cemented for me about 5 years after I came to the United States when I came to the United States in 77 to go to Swarthmore College. And then I didn't go back to Iran for 20 years after that. But the revolution, when it came, brought many of my parents' friends to the United States, as well as other people that I didn't know. And in the early 80s, when I was sitting in exile communities talking to friends and relatives of my parents, I met someone who was very high up in the Iranian secret police under the Shah. And I can't say for a fact that he was a torturer, but all the evidence suggests that he was certainly present when much happened. And what was shocking to me was how sophisticated he was, how educated, how philosophical, how would I put it? I mean, he knew French theater and opera, and yet this extreme form of sophistication probably was combined with a deep sense of brutality. And I was my father introduced me, and he was very curious about the work I did, and I told him. And he seemed completely impervious to...
Were you working on torture then already?
Yeah, I was working on my master's thesis at that point. Yeah, he was somewhat impervious to this. And in fact, I showed him a series of photographs of torture that I'd taken over, that I'd gathered from the 1880s onwards to the present. And he looked... It was sort of a transition from classical to modern torture. And he looked at it, and he looked at the modern stuff and the old stuff, and he said, "Isn't it amazing what the king saved us from, and now we've gone back to it?" And I was having a great deal of trouble with that one, because I couldn't understand how someone could look at the same set of photographs and draw that conclusion. So that was a real instructive moment to me, because, you know, everybody kind of thinks that when evil walks in the door, it's going to have horns on its head and a tail. And actually... You know, I didn't have to read Eichmann in Jerusalem or any Hannah Arendt to understand that basically much that happens in the world happens without that. Basically, when evil walks in the door, it usually has a good French education or an American education and invites you out for a beer and is very friendly. And that's fine. I mean, I realize that understanding the history of my relatives and understanding that people make choices and they have consequences was very important to me in being able to deal with those situations. Does that help?
No, that's great. Well, all right, where I want to go next is, I mean, one thing that you know, and that feels important to me as context for whatever, for the discussion we're having about torture now, and the discussion we may continue to have. Is that that this culture, U.S. culture, has a history with this as well.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think we like to think that we don't have a history of torture at all.
Right. I mean, some tone being set here that, well, for this brief period, we betrayed our best traditions and have done something completely astonishing, but that's not really true to the big picture.
That's right. We don't. I mean, the history of torture in democratic societies, I should say, you know, right off the bat, is not anywhere comparable to the history of torture in authoritarian societies. Mm-hmm. I mean, they truly deserve their reputation for cruelty. But that said, it's not to say that we don't have a history. We just have a different history. Mm-hmm. And our history, really in the last 200 years, begins with our transition, our effort to break away from what we might call savage or our bloody punishments, like whipping, for example, to other forms of coercion. And this is, of course, characteristic of all democratic societies, because one of the ideas behind democracies is that you use no more force than is necessary to perform your job, whereas, you know, authoritarian states don't care. Not surprisingly, when torture comes back into the life of democracies, it comes back often in the 20th century in a clean form. That is to say, it doesn't leave many marks.
You're talking about this kind of stealth torture.
Yeah, I do. And I think this is different. I mean, because, you know, one thing to remember is that democracies going as far back as the Greeks and the Romans had legalized torture, and the Renaissance republics did too. But what's different about ours is that we're liberal democracies. And so naturally we have certain conceptions of individual rights, and there are organizations, church groups, human rights groups, press, who watch police, military, when they perform the actions that they do. And so if you leave a bloody trail behind you, then you produce a scandal or you create damage to your organization. Many things can happen. And so very early on, in the late 19th century, it becomes clear, as these types of organizations become more active in United States and France and England, the police clean up their act. Mm-hmm. And basically, when we're watching, cops get sneaky. And so not surprisingly, we started using techniques different from authoritarian states, techniques that left few marks.
And I mean, you make this interesting point that it's kind of a double-edged sword, that we citizens of a democratic culture, that there are these ways to monitor this, and yet then I think you said torture has changed in ways we become complicit in, that this pressure, in fact, makes this become more hidden.
Yeah, it's a perverse effect of monitoring. On the one hand, sort of the model that we have is if outrage happens and we draw it to the attention of the public will mobilize and things will change. And the lesson that people who want to commit outrageous acts draw from that is, well, then let's make sure outrage doesn't happen. And then it tends to disappear. And I mean, the value of a clean technique basically is that the public can't tell how much pain someone is in. I mean, if I told you that I'm depriving you of sleep or waterboarding you, that's different than if you can stand up in front of a camera and show me a gigantic scar of a whip across your chest.
Right.
And that just is a very visceral thing. People judge more by what they see than what they hear about. And so these kinds of things disappear. It doesn't mean that we can't see them. And, you know, there are doctors and there are experts who now can identify clean techniques. But then it becomes a battle of experts. There is a perverse effect. And, you know, one of the conclusions I kind of reluctantly draw from this is that, you know, torture doesn't just hide in some military barracks somewhere. It locates itself often, when it's not politically approved, in barracks and fraternities and families. And that's where it really hides. And it's only when the top authorizes or allows, says, okay, boys, you can do this, that the bottom comes running out with the practices. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that torture's these kinds of practices that I'm talking about are exactly that, practices like sexual practices. You know, government can authorize them, legalize them, make them less permissible or not, but they will disappear. You know, prohibiting them just pushes them underground. It's not that they disappear entirely.
Is it right, you've said that electro torture began in the United States in the early 20th century? And was this part of the reason for that?
Yeah, it's certainly the first. It's the first cases that we know of people being subjected to electricity in a incarcerated condition. And I should explain what I study, I suppose. What I mean by torture is that someone was detained and helpless, and there's a state agent who's applying electrical pain in this case for purposes of intimidation or confession or information. Mm-hmm. And the first case we have of something like this involving electricity happened somewhere between 1900 and 1910. The anarchist philosopher Emma Goldman used to receive letters from prisoners in various prisons around the United States, and she describes a device called the hummingbird, which was used to keep order in New York prisons, which was electrical. And I suspect that it was something like a cattle prod, and it hummed with electricity. The first really certain case that we have of electrical torture was probably the electrical monkey, which was a device, a magneto, that was used by the Dallas police in 1916. And it was called the electrical monkey because it was applied to African Americans to secure confessions. Mm. So electrical monkey. Mm. And then, of course, there are a number of other instances that follow. Electricity was, and most people don't realize it, in the early 20th century, very much an American thing. It defined us as a people. And so it's not surprisingly that even the police adopted these kinds of techniques in the United States before Europeans did.
You also use the word torture to describe treatment of blacks, of African Americans in the South into the 50s, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, what's really important is if the person is a state agent or whether the state allows for or designates mm-hmm. Other groups of people to do enforcement for it. So, for example, a death squad that tortures and keeps order on behalf of the state, I'm certainly willing to make the case that that's torture, similarly with lynching and things like that. I do think that there's a sort of – the history of torture is part of the broader history of cruelty. And there's certainly a relationship between the two. Okay. Techniques from the history of cruelty pass on to the history of torture. But what is really different about torture is that it involves the public trust. That is to say, when I am held in a prison, in a basement, and my neighbor decides that he doesn't like my sidewalk and decides to torture me to make sure that I improve, he applies only the physical force that he himself is capable of. When I am detained in a prison and he is a state agent, then he applies this with the full trust and public authority and all the resources that the state gives you. And that has always been, going back to the Romans, one of the characteristics of torture, that it involves the public trust. Whether you believe, as the Romans, that this is a good thing, or whether you believe, as the United Nations, that this is a bad thing, all these definitions include the use or abuse of the public trust, because once you give someone political authority, they have a lot more power over you. Mm-hmm. And when they abuse it, then it becomes not just a crime, it becomes a war crime. And we treat it differently. The same thing is true of war. A fight between two individuals is maybe a duel, but it's never a war. It requires a state, and the violation of the public rules of war, whatever those might be, for something to become a war crime. Because again, when you kill someone on your own, that's murder or assault.
Right.
When you engage with the public trust, it's another thing entirely.
So in 2009, we are reckoning with a new form of this. And I want to read you a little bit of the way. So this is from a New York Times summary of the revelations of torture in the Bush administration, kind of trying to lay out what we had learned and were learning. And I want to ask you if you think this is the right way to tell this story.
Okay.
And I think it's legitimate to quote the New York Times because it is a real definitive voice in our cultural and political narrative and will be for as long as it continues to exist. So here's what they said. And again, I think that's interesting that this is written as, you know, here are the facts. Okay. There are no conditional words in here. It's like we're going to tell you just the bare bones facts. All right. In its scramble to create a system, the agency made the momentous decision to use harsh methods that the government had long condemned. It borrowed its techniques from an American military training program modeled on the torture repertories of the Soviet Union and other Cold War adversaries, a lineage that would come to haunt the agency. Is that the story you would tell about what happened in these last years?
It's part of the story. Mm-hmm. I would say that any account, and we'll see this in about 10 or 15 years, of what happened in the last few years won't be a simple line. It's okay. Going to be multifaceted.
And what's kind of interesting to me about that is this idea that in its scramble to create a system— that there was nothing, yeah. And then there was something, and that that something was taken from another culture, not our own. You know what I'm hearing there?
Yeah, no, I that's right. Well, you mean the going from we were completely clueless.
Completely clueless, had only condemned it, and we had to find something that had happened in the Soviet Union to have techniques. I don't know. Maybe that's true, but it feels.
Yeah, I guess the first thing I would do is I would distinguish in the story between where the demand for tough techniques came from and where the supply. I mean, they're very different kinds of things. The demand side of this, I mean, I guess I feel like these days we're all economists, so I'm talking
right.
like demand
right.
and supply. But I think that's a really important distinction. On the one hand, I think it's clear that in Washington there was a demand for intelligence and information, and also a series of decisions were made to set prisoners outside of any kind of legal protections, which is often sort of exactly the way in which torture happens, where as soon as you put someone in a place where they're not monitored and there are no clear rules and there are no legal protections, then bad things typically follow. Mm. So that is a predisposition, and they didn't know what works. But, you know, and then the flip side of it is, well, once they authorized it, where did the techniques come from? And that's the supply side. And most people think, well, these techniques actually come from people's abnormal psychology, or they come from a vault in the CIA or at SEER. Whereas, in fact, these techniques have a long history in the United States. We have similar techniques like waterboarding documented in INS detention centers in Miami in the 1990s. Mm. We have accounts of waterboarding by Texas police officers in the 1980s. These are old techniques. It's important to recognize that torture is a style or a craft, and torturers tend to be creatures of habit. And so they're not usually abnormal. They're usually chosen to be normal, loyal, patriotic, can keep a secret kinds of people. This is one of the things that my book kind of Torture and Democracy kind of shows out, which is that there are really two modern traditions, and one of them, the Anglo-Saxon tradition of torture, what I call Anglo-Saxon modern, is it's a tradition that was certainly there among security agencies and police long before there were memos and long before there was a system. And I'll give you an example. I think many people think that, you know, torture happened once the memos arrived. I mean, and this is a very peculiar notion that somehow the CIA waits for a document before it goes out and does stuff, or that the army waits for a document, whereas much torture that we know doesn't fit that characteristic model at all. And I think when the histories are written, I think they will discover, and I think there's some evidence of this already, that torture had begun in the United States under United, sorry, torture had begun in Afghanistan as early as January 2002, long before the memos were written. There's a case in which I have entered in a submission in Washington, D.C., where the person who was tortured, or at least, you know, whatever the techniques that, you know, we now dispute over, those techniques were being used on this person and several other people in detention in Kandahar in January of 2002. That's 6 months before any legal documents were ever written.
Oh, yeah. And I think when you read those memos, it's clear that what's going on is a justification. It's finding legal language to justify something.
Right. I mean, yeah, this doesn't change the I want to blame someone argument. It just says that those documents are it's the cover-up that's more dangerous than the authorization. You know, it's these documents authorize things that probably were already in motion on the ground. And we don't know, I certainly don't know, what people were doing before. But I understand, for example, that well, actually, I'm not even going to go there, right? Because I don't want to sort of jeopardize legal cases. But in any case, you know, there is a kind of fetishization of documents where we somehow think that the document is really evidence of what happened. You know, and that only captures a part of it. And let me give you a completely different example.
Okay.
When the Nuremberg people wanted to try the Gestapo for torture, the French and Russian prosecutors, they looked for documents. And, you know, we have documents that say in 1937, the Justice Ministry sat down with the Gestapo and they agreed on a multiple point interrogation method called sharpened interrogation, which involved beating someone with a stick a certain number of times. A doctor should be present. Everything should be done. Permission only authorized from Berlin. Forms needed to be filled out. And we have a reissue of that document in 1942 by Gestapo Chief Mueller. And now all of a sudden there are a number of new techniques and of what we would undoubtedly call torture, but they're not like whipping or any of the things that the Gestapo is famous for. They're more like for standing, sleep deprivation, all sorts of things like that. And then the number of people to whom this could be applied to has also increased. And yet we know that Gestapo torture on the ground bore no resemblance to what is in these memos. And we also know that almost nobody – I mean, we have no completed forms asking for permission from Berlin. We have one uncompleted form from Slovenia. And it seems that however much you want to clothe torture in bureaucracy, torture has these slippery slopes. The number of techniques increases, the number of victims and the types of victims increase, and basically torturers become a force unto themselves, independent of the lawyers who try to regulate them.
Right.
And that's that's one of the reasons why torturers and torture bureaucracies constitute huge dangers to states, whether they're authoritarian or democratic. I mean, let me give you one last example.
Okay.
The Bybee and the Bradbury memos, which were released.
The lawyers, the torture memos.
The lawyers, which are the torture memos. I mean, nobody else but me would be interested in this, but if you count the number of techniques that are in the Bybee memo, they are about one-third less than the techniques that appear in the Bradbury memo. And the less intrusive techniques in the Bybee memo disappear. And new techniques are added in the Bradbury memo. I mean, that's a I mean, it's not – I don't think that Bradbury was counting the techniques, but it's pretty clear that there is a slippery slope and things were just running out of control. The legal language gives a false sense that this is actually policy or control when it's not.
Right. So part of the public focus after the release of this has been who knew when. Right.
Yes.
And so here's again, and in fact, it's just turning into this focal point So here's again from that New York Times summary. You know, a high level, I guess this was published earlier this year in the New York Times. A series of high level meetings in 2002 led to an official embracing of harsh interrogation methods. Without a single dissent from cabinet members or lawmakers, the extraordinary consensus was possible largely because no one involved, not the top two CIA officers pushing the program, not the senior aides to Mr. Bush, not the leaders of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, investigated the gruesome origins of the techniques they were proving with little debate. What I want to ask you is, I wonder if that's a common feature of the kind of decision-making that sets these kinds of practices in motion or validates them. I can imagine people didn't want to know. They didn't want to know the gruesome techniques, right?
Right. Either you knew or you didn't know. If you knew, then the incentive was for you to pretend that you were ignorant. Uh-huh. And if you didn't know as little as you possibly could. That's right. I mean, I think and what assists people in this is that these techniques, as I say, very few of these techniques leave marks. Most people, for example, don't know that sleep deprivation isn't depriving someone of their naps. But what it does is it actually creates deep muscle pains and aches in all your joints within 24 to 48 hours. So combined with forced standing or any kind of stress position, it can be excruciating. They also didn't explore, let's suppose that you really did think that these techniques had gruesome origins. They never explored also what these techniques did in terms of the information you got.
Right.
So, for example, sleep deprivation was famously used for false confessions. And it was used by the Soviets and the North Koreans and the Chinese for false confessions.
You mean across the decades?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And that's because basically once you're deprived of sleep, you can't tell where you're getting your information from. So if I repeatedly ask you, did you see Mr. Smith? You're pretty soon going to have some vivid, vivid memories of Mr. Smith under repeated questioning. And this is why, sleep deprivation, when it first emerged in the hands of Englishmen and Scots, it happened during witch hunts where you got these magnificent confessions of meeting with the devil. Now, it's important to recognize that even the Inquisition hated sleep deprivation because they realized that it produced inaccurate information. And yet when you read these documents, it's as if though this is a magical cure and that we can get accurate information from them. So there is, regardless of whether you know the origins or not, a tremendous amount of ignorance about these techniques.
Hmm. And, you make a statement that from something from all your research that torture creates an unprofessional atmosphere. And, it seems to me that unprofessional atmosphere, that's also one way you can describe what's happening in these cabinet meetings or briefings of lawmakers where they don't ask these complicated questions about the consequences.
Torture has a deprofessionalization effect, unquestionably so. And that's because basically you think the gist of it boils down to I might be doing everything according to the rules, but if I just stay within the rules, then I might lose my job or I might not get the benefits from it. So I'm going to edge the rules up and apply one more technique or apply one more torture. And pretty soon torturers who want to be professionals end up looking like sadists, even though that's not what they're doing. But yeah, torture is very dangerous for four professions, basically: lawyers, politicians, medical professionals, and journalists. It's dangerous for all of them because they can kind of get sucked into this little step by step where they don't necessarily once you've accepted the first element of it, then they feel sort of compelled. Slippery slopes happen not because – they happen for a couple of – two or three reasons. One is that peer pressure, which is that as a group we're not going to notice – the big elephant in the room. And right. if the group basically says no, then you won't really break the consensus. Another reason that peer pressure happens or slippery slopes and torture happen is that people they feel compromised. So they'll say, I've drunk a cup of – I've taken a free cup of coffee, so then why not take the whole can or something like that? I've drunk a bit of it. I've done a little evil, and so I'm already committed. So I just hope that it works through. And lastly, I think – and it's hard to underestimate how this affects the other two – is that when you have fuzzy backgrounds, when you don't know the threat you're confronting, when you can't distinguish between civilians and terrorists and however that works for you, fuzzy backgrounds – combined with peer pressure and a sense that we're already implicated can really drive a slippery slope and make it much slipperier for medical officers and psychologists and politicians.
So, I don't know if this is what you're thinking of when you say that, but, one thing I don't really want to talk to you about here is whether torture works or not, quote unquote,
Thank
works,
God.
Right? but it seems to me that to the extent that there's been a discussion all these years, either in those secret places or publicly, I mean, this is a way in which it seems to me, what you say, politicians, doctors, journalists, what was the other one? Military or the others?
Let's
who,
see, doc-
for
doctors,
whom this is dangerous.
Doctors, journalists, lawyers, and
oh, lawyers. That this question, this narrow question of does it work or not, hijacked the discussion and. In fact, was a distraction and a narrowing from other discussions we might have been having about larger consequences, not efficacy, but consequences.
Yeah, no, it's certainly true. I mean, the central question ought to have been, what is good counterterrorism policy? Mm-hmm. And by those standards, torture is terrible good counterterrorism policy. And I think most policing professionals would tell you that. But yes, the other side of this is consequences. Most people are unaware that once you authorize a torture bureaucracy, it has a number of unforeseen consequences. One of them is it. Let's put it in its most basic form. When you authorize torture, you give one individual, however you want to describe this, absolute power over another individual. And we can't look at the history of slavery without knowing how corrupting that is to a society. And we can't look at the history of torture without knowing how corrupting that is to societies or to governments that authorize it. It sets into motion a series of changes which often take 10 to 20 years for them to work out of a society. And some of them are bureaucratic. For example, a split develops in your agency between the professionals who want to do proper policing methods and the torturers who just want to whack the guy with a bat or stick his head in a vat of water. And usually one side or the other leaves. In the American case, many, many professionals, FBI, CIA, et cetera, left the agencies. So that's one. But the other problem is you train a group of people to torture. What are they going to do afterwards? When they're decommissioned, where do torturers
right,
go?
Right, right.
And the answer is that they go to private security and local police forces around your home and mine. And so torture that was international becomes domestic. I think most people know what waterboarding is, but most people don't understand that waterboarding was something that American forces first learned. A technique for the most part, this particular technique was learned for the most part during their campaign, the American campaign in the Philippines in 1905. And when these troops come back to the United States, they become police officers all throughout the United States. And by the 1930s, the American Bar Association Committee documents that waterboarding is pretty common, especially in the American South. Hmm. So techniques come home. Same thing with Chicago Torture has been documented in Chicago from 73 to 93. And the techniques that appear there, the electrical techniques, were first documented in American hands in southern Vietnam in 1963. So I think most people are unaware of the incredibly long shadow that torture casts, not just for a government, but for a society. And lastly, I think for the families that are involved in this process. You know, the cases of atrocity-related trauma that are tied to torture are the domestic abuse, alcoholism, suicide rates. None of these things are calculated when people think about torture.
Now, you mentioned that there were police professionals who knew, at least understood much of this, that this is not a good policy for many reasons. And you know, I had a conversation with Jane Mayer, who's of course done excellent reporting on this for The New Yorker, who talked about all the military lawyers who resigned.
Yes.
Now, maybe I haven't been reading the right things, but I kind of feel like that's a story that hasn't been told. Who left? Because they knew? Because they had other kinds of information?
There's a whole book to be written on that. Not only who left, but what happened to the whistleblowers, the people who said no. And, you know, I mean, there were certainly the military lawyers were the first. In fact, I think what's really interesting about that story is that, during Watergate, it was the civilian lawyers that broke with the presidency. You know, so John Dean and it's John Dean, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this case, during the Watergate, it was the civilian lawyers who did that. Whereas in this case, the civilian lawyers proved to be very malleable. Whereas the military lawyers, who had a much stronger sense of the implications of torture, for example, for the treatment of our soldiers should they ever fall into enemy hands, they understood immediately that the consequences of these kinds of techniques would be that they would put American soldiers at risk in future conflicts. And so they went and I believe they approached Scott Horton, who was head of the Human Rights Committee for the New York Bar Association, and they and then they discussed, you know, and they broke, right? But I think the sort of general problem is that there were some people along the line, not just the military lawyers, but say Captain Fishback. There were people within the CIA.
Right, people who left rather than take part in the new policy.
And who said these things and then were driven out, you know. Colonel Kleiman. I mean, one of the things that I think we have on the books is whistleblower laws. But it's pretty clear that the whistleblower laws in this case broke. And the whoever office was responsible for managing this either failed to follow these techniques or did not do a particularly good job of following up techniques, Army CID or whatever the particular version is. I mean, I'm sure people will analyze these in due course. But what I think is important is that we really don't know. We know a lot more about what leads people to do evil, I guess, than what leads people to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. And what the stories of the whistleblowers tell me is that basically either you have to have a strong commitment like the military lawyers do to an alternative life, such as military code of honor or something like that, or you have to have a deep religious foundation like Captain Fishback. And this is consistent with what we know from other cases where people said no. For example, during the French-Algerian War, the people who objected to torture in Algeria were either evangelical Catholics like General Boulardier or Auschwitz survivors or you know, concentration camp survivors like Prefect Tietgen or members of the French Socialist Party who disagreed with
who had a strong system
the policies
of ideas.
Yeah, who had an alternative set of values. It's very important to have an alternative set of values to be able to stand. And if you don't, then the system gives your values for you.
And, you know, another thing that Jane Mayer talks about is all – and I don't think this is out really there – that all the doctors and the scientists who became involved in justifying this. And there, you know, you do think of the system of – you'd think of do no harm, right, at least with the medical profession. And it's very hard to imagine how that was reconciled.
Yeah, although, again, when we think about it in the broad scale of things, it isn't surprising. Doctors have been involved in torture for a very long time. Prison doctors in particular have a very different – or military doctors have very different involvement and personal associations with the military or the prison officers that they work with. And it shouldn't surprise us that doctors get involved in these things. What is again, you know, I would imagine that with doctors, the central concern is whether they really do believe that they have a certain kind of connection. I mean, I'll give you another famous example. There were doctors in Northern Ireland in the 1970s who were noticing the bruises and scars that were left, very faint ones, but that were left on prisoners who'd been interrogated by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And the they documented these. They tried to raise protests within the system. They were constantly shut down. And then finally they went out and gave the press all the details. Mm. And this turned out to be a gigantic scandal that brought down, I think, the Labour government contributed to it for sure at the time. So prison doctors do actually have these commitments. But again, they are perhaps more caught up in the system.
You're right.
Because they basically, like soldiers, are supposed to appeal within the system before they appeal outside of it. And by that time, they feel so implicated sometimes that they can't really say anything. And others, of course, as you say, just work along with it because for whatever reasons, they don't think that these things constitute torture or that they will ever be called to account for it.
So tell me something of what you know about what effect torture has on the torturer.
Well, we have studies of Greek and Brazilian and French torturers. Those are our main cases and a few American stories. What we know is that everything depends. Atrocity-related trauma, which is one of the things that some torturers have, very much depends on how guilty you feel. And if you have a very strong ideological disposition to regard the other side as inhuman, then it's like the Gestapo guards. They don't develop atrocity-related trauma in the norm. Whereas if you feel like you're just torturing someone out of necessity, which is almost characteristic of the democratic torturer, then, yeah, you can develop all sorts of issues related to atrocity-related trauma like irritability, spontaneous, you know, expressions of anger, potential suicide, you know, various sorts of things like that. But beyond that, what we know, even if you don't develop atrocity-related trauma, is that you experience job burnout. This is really one of the things that the study of the Brazilian torturers really spells out for you quite clearly, which is that, you know, if someone was involved in a death squad, they feel like that's, you know, much more, how would I put it, exciting, that their job is done once they've fired the bullet like James Bond. And they don't take their work home. Whereas what most people forget is that torture is a labor-intensive activity. I mean, when we talk about boarding KSM for 183 times, that's a lot of work and a lot of hours. And you take your work home with you. And that's – there's all sorts of sort of anxieties related to job performance and competitiveness that appears among torturers. Why should – because torture is basically a zero-sum game. If I have worked up softening up this person for the last 2 hours, why should I surrender him to you and have you break this person and get all the glory I could just hang on and just – if I was just a bit more violent and a bit more cruel, I might get the reward myself. This is very different than the kind of normal competition between, say, two policemen working on a case where I work on fingerprinting and you work on clues. This becomes it encourages cruelty as opposed to discourages cruelty.
And you have described kind of toxic levels of shame is the way you've described it eventually.
That's right. And it doesn't happen because, like, they have this huge revelatory moment where, you know, they've been reading Jane Mayer and it just dawns on them, oh, I've been doing torture.
Right.
Much as we would hope that this is the way it happens, often it happens in unexpected ways. You go to a movie, everyone describes what's happening in the movie as torture, and you think, well, that's not as bad as what I did. And then you begin to realize that, oh, what they're thinking of is that what I did is torture. So it happens not because there's this big revelatory moment, but it can dawn on you very slowly over time. The other thing I will say is that all our information, and this is important to keep in mind, all our information about torturers comes after the fact. It's not like we can go in and interview torturers.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, torturers tailor their stories to the political conditions which they find themselves in. So if, for example, the society turns against torture, then it wouldn't be surprising for torturers to say, yeah, I'm really suffering, or I didn't mean to do it. Or so. Whereas if, for example, the society has never resolved the torture issue, they may be much more unrepentant.
Mm-hmm.
They may be much more certain. So there's different stories that torturers tell depending on the political conditions that they perceive.
I think something in your work that seems important to me now as we work through what's happened in the U.S. Is you note that the deep trauma that can be there for torture, people who have tortured, that the trauma is deepest among those who were closest to it. So the foot soldiers rather than the commanders. The facilitators are less affected than the implementers.
Right. That's another characteristic that we find from the cases, which is that the higher up the chain of command you are, the less evidence of guilt or shame or any of these things. The lower down, the more culpable you are. And there's something – it can't be denied. There's something very visceral about applying pain to someone's – to another human being, putting hand on flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that just stays with you, whereas if you just order it, it's different.
And yet, I mean, to come back to these words of Abraham Joshua Heschel that I think apply in so many situations. In a democracy, while some are guilty, all are responsible. I mean, there's a sense in which we, all of us as citizens, have to reckon with these things now that we know. We can't escape that knowledge. We're done in our name. And yet it's clear that we're not going to be traumatized in the way that the people who enacted it, and that even the doctors and lawyers aren't going to be traumatized the way the people working in military prisons.
That's true.
Maybe.
That's true. And I think – well, I mean, I guess this is a distinction I would draw between sort of active injustice and passive injustice. You know, the active injustice is the people who did it. The passive injustice presumably is the people who stood by and didn't intervene or prevent things from happening. And the question is, of course, both prospective and retrospective. I'm much more interested in the prospective question. But let me just briefly say, retrospectively speaking, it's really questionable what all of us could have done. I mean, one of the things that I'm very familiar with is I've been following American public opinion polling on torture and ticking time bombs since 2001, and the American public, I mean, there's a sort of impression among journalists and politicians that most Americans actually approved of torture, especially in a ticking time bomb situation, especially if the person has high level information that might save American lives. But when you look at all the polls, and we just finished this big comprehensive archive of them, of 30 polls that all involve ticking time bomb or urgent terrorist questions, there has never been a pro torture majority in America. In fact, opposition to torture has consistently been exactly the same, roughly between 55 and 60%.
Okay.
And support for torture has always been about 35%, with lows as low as 15 and highs as 49, depending on the question you asked. But I mean, even when we don't even use the word torture, when we just say, would you use this technique if you thought that there was a high-value person with high-value information and you were assured that this technique had a high chance of working, Americans still oppose it. I mean, waterboarding gets a 70 to 80% negative rating on that, even when you don't use the word torture. So I'm actually not too worried about the condition of the American public. I think the American public repeatedly said to pollsters what they thought,
right. But
they were deeply misrepresented by politicians and journalists. There was a kind of false consensus about what was out there. So retrospectively thinking, I'm not sure what more the American people could have done to express their outrage. Maybe some of us could have formed a social movement. But in fact, that's what's happening now, right?
Right.
I mean, what's
happening
now is that finally we're getting our anti-torture movement. It was bound to happen. It happened in France as a result of the Algerian War. And it brought together an alliance from across the spectrum, from the right to the left. In France, it brought together, for the first time since the French Revolution, the Catholic Church and the left-wing socialists.
Okay.
Because there's – and we're seeing the
Are
same
seeing
thing here.
Are you seeing that kind of spectrum uniting here?
We're seeing the same
US?
Thing here. I mean, we're seeing, on the one hand, evangelicals who are opposed to torture.
Yes.
We're seeing Republicans like Andrew Sullivan. You know, I mean, the important thing is torture doesn't break on the Democratic-Republican line. Now, it's very hard, if you look at the polls, to actually say, oh, all Democrats favor this and all Republicans favor that. Torture is one of these things that cuts across those things much more than we think. You know, Republicans and Democrats are anti-torture, and then the Republicans and Democrats who are pro-torture.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Democrats you know, I think – I know he doesn't like being called this, but I mean, Alan Dershowitz, for example, who's a civil rights lawyer, actually has talked about justifying torture in extreme circumstances.
Right.
So,
you've
you know,
been
I
in
think,
discussions with him, haven't you?
Well, it was – yeah, mm-hmm. it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is that it – this isn't a Democrat-Republican line. It's about values, and it's about much more fundamental values about whether any human being can be given the power to abuse another human being. And you can be a Republican and have very strong views on that.
But, you know, in terms of the looking forward, the reckoning that may now happen or be happening, you know, there are some challenging insights that you have from your work that, for example, I don't think were applied in the way we talked about Abu Ghraib, right? You know,
what do you have in mind?
Well, you know, we kind of treated it as a few bad apples. And,
yeah.
And I've even heard President Obama, when he was talking about not releasing the photos, say, you know, things that were done by a few people. I'm not sure that was exactly the phrase he used.
Yeah.
But you've talked about conversations you had with lawyers of the of at least one of the people of the people who were charged of Abu Ghraib, and you said. You told them you understand that that client is not a monster or a sadist, that most of us, given the right set of incentives, would torture, that is the evidence of 40 years of social scientific research, which is pretty chilling.
That's right. I mean, I think, again, this goes back to my point that evil doesn't walk around in horns or shiny jackboots. You know, I think the The evidence of 40 years of social science basically falls on the side of what would be called a dispositional, let me repeat this again. Mm-hmm. There are basically two possible ways in which you can account for why people do torture. The first is that they have a disposition for cruelty and so they are bad apples. And the other is that the situation put in the right way can give incentives for anybody to torture. And we began the 20th century thinking that people who tortured had certain dispositions that made them cruel. And then we discovered basically two things. First of all, that organizations that torture make sure that the people who torture are not sadists because sadists don't follow rules. They choose people to follow rules and be patriotic. If you kill the guy and get pleasure out of it, you've kind of failed to get the information. So that's a problem. And this is true, we discovered, not just among democratic states, but say in Cambodia when we look at the genocide and the torture at Tol Slung. We actually have the interrogation, the torture manual from Tol Slung. And in it, the head torturer says to his people, you have to be more disciplined, more ideological. If you just keep on doing on the pain side of things, you may kill the person before we need the information we get. Clearly, it's a problem, even in authoritarian conditions. People get sucked up by the pain. So part of it is that we have very little evidence that people are chosen because they're sadists to become torturers historically. On top of that, we have psychological evidence that suggests that given the right set of incentives, unclear rules, two types of authority, no punishment for which set of rules you follow, no regular monitoring either, and no remand before a judge, we can pretty much predict that violence is going to happen, maybe not specifically torture. But once you have conditions like that, this is what the Milgram – well, certainly the Zimbardo experiment shows.
Just summarize that, would you?
Well, the Zimbardo experiment was a mock prison experiment held in Stanford and in which very normal people, all American men, college students, were given two sets of roles, one set were defined as guards, one set were defined as prisoners, and they were created into a mock prison in the basement of the psychology building at Stanford. And all they did was play out the roles. And what happened within 2 or 3 days was that they had to stop the experiment because violent behavior – the guards started moving very rapidly towards violent behavior. And this was – surprising given how normal all these kids were when they went in. Yeah. So the social science on this keeps on coming back saying it's the situation, not the disposition, that makes people evil, all of us, given the right circumstances. Having said that, I think I've told you, there are people who can say no. I mean, that's really important to recognize.
Right. And you said we don't have the social science on them as much.
Yeah. You know, we're just so fascinated with evil and not with why people do good. And, you know, I mean, Milgram is a very great example. He was interested in how far people would apply electroshock to someone under the guise of authority. And, you know, in most cases, they did. But there were a significant number who didn't, and he never did the follow-up interviews.
Did you say it was about a third of them said
it's
no?
It's about a third,
and was it also about a third of people at Abu Ghraib who said no?
I have no idea. Okay. I know that, you know, obviously Specialist Darby said no. And Specialist Darby was no different. Specialist Darby was the person who gave us the photos. Mm-hmm. He came from the same unit in West Virginia. I think there's nothing in his background that suggests that he was any different than the people who went with him. But for whatever reason, he, I gather, slid the photographs under the door of Army CID, and then there was a note that was posted that said, come back and we can't initiate charges unless investigations unless you come in person. And so then he came in person. So it's hard to know what moved him. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he has his own story now because, again, he was another one of those whistleblowers who had to leave in fear.
You know, in terms of pictures, you said something when we first began to speak that, of course, is a little difficult for me as a radio person to hear. But you said that we're galvanized more by what we see than what we hear.
Yeah.
And no, I think that, you know, again, we don't know what's between the time we have this conversation and the program airs. The pictures may be released. But how do you just in the abstract, or, you know, aside from what happens right now at this moment in time, how do you think about the value or drawbacks of photographs being released of this kind of activity? Is that, let's say, for these deeper questions that we might want to reckon with in terms of our culture and us as citizens who may have been complicit, how do pictures play into that, help or hinder it?
Well, I'm pretty sure they can do both. I mean, the hooded man photo has essentially become iconic. And as an icon, it can both be used now by people who want to discredit the United States by showing it, and it certainly can be used internationally as a symbol of American torture now. Mm-hmm. But conversely, I think the hooded man photo was absolutely pivotal in galvanizing American public opinion on this question. I think the events at Abu Ghraib happened months before, and there were even news reports of this incident 2 or 3 months before. There were even legal trials. There was a Reuters story, I think, in February. But it was only when CBS broke the embargo on the photographs and released them that
there was an outcry.
Mm-hmm. So sight really – visual things really matters, which is, again, you know, the truth behind the work that I've been doing, that cleanliness and torture is a big deal. And what can short-circuit cleanliness is a photograph, right, because it can show complicity. It can show the actual moment. And it can be valuable in a court trial, obviously, as, you know, Lindy England and all these other people discovered. So it can also be very important in terms of pinning responsibility and identifying who was there.
You know, I'd like to read an email that we actually just got before I walked into the studio with you. Somebody telling us it's time for us to address torture on this show. And and obviously we've been thinking about that. So I'm just going to read this to you. And as for your response, it seems that America is torn between the supposed noble ends and the seemingly ugly means. Should we torture sometimes? Is it at all justifiable? If it works, is it okay? What about the long-term consequences? What about the victims? I saw this survey, he goes on, that said churchgoers in the U.S. are more likely to approve the use of torture. Is this shocking only to me? What about exposing evil? Should we expose that ugliness? Is it better to air it out or keep it under the rug? The Muslim world is not angry at us only because we torture, but also because of hypocrisy. We preach human rights all the time. If we release the photos and hold people accountable, it may go a long way in showing that we are serious, sincere, and that we have moral standards. But we are not perfect. We are a country of laws. Everybody's equal before the law. Now, obviously, this is kind of stream of consciousness, but I think
it certainly
he's
is.
Really, but he's really naming a lot of questions, some of which we haven't even begun to ask collectively.
Yeah, it's true. Well, let me begin with the easiest one.
Okay.
In that stream,
you don't have to reply to it all.
Well, there are some very, very interesting. When I hear it, well, let me just begin with a personal note. Mm-hmm. When I hear an email like that, it takes me back to my childhood and growing up under the king and growing up with all these high-minded aristocratic values.
The king of Iran.
Yeah, Shah. and being a Shah, but also coming from an old family which had, you know, tremendous weight on doing the honorable thing and doing the just and merciful thing, and yet with a much more mixed history. And I remember, I mean, my great-grandfather turn cannons on crowds during the Constitutional Revolution. And people said of him, I mean, he certainly didn't hesitate to apply harsh methods in defense of his values. And, you know, people said of him, look, he talks big, but it's pretty clear that all these values that the aristocracy has are just a sham. They're fake. And, you know, if they have to use violence to defend them, what value do they have? And I think, frankly, they were right. And nobody mourned the passing of his world, frankly. And likewise, when the king kept on attacking Khomeini for being a medieval guy, Khomeini turned around and said, I don't know who's medieval. I mean, I'm not the guy who's torturing. Mm-hmm. And this turned out to be huge in terms of getting people to his side. And most people forget that the Iranian Revolution, one of its central features of the Islamic Revolution, was that it was a revolution against torture. And it was one of the first things that was sort of introduced into the new Islamic constitution. Now, of course, you know, obviously follow through has been somewhat more problematic. But the point is that whenever we defend our values in that way, the charge of hypocrisy is coming and gives and you know, Al-Qaeda's sort of argument against us is identical, which is that they talk human rights, but it's obviously a sham. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what this boils down to is a famous old question, which is it better to be loved or feared? And I think, and would we rather be loved and for our human rights values, or should we be feared because we're a very powerful country? And I think the American answer has always been, if we fight with one hand behind our back and win, we will be both loved and feared. Because if we're merely loved for our human rights values but really can't enforce them, then we will be despised. And if we are merely loved, merely feared because we are potentially violent, fear doesn't hold people in place or give them any respect for what you do. I think that's the American answer. It's the American way, really, is that we defeat the Germans with one hand tied behind our back, and we can do this in this case as well. I mean, I really think that that's where we fall as a nation. One thing I would say about the churchgoers,
right,
is
the, that the listeners' assertion, and I think this idea is out there that there are polls. You said you've studied lots of polls, but there are polls that show, I think, that people who attend church more frequently are more likely to support terror.
Right. I mean, I think the answer there is people who attend church more frequently also tend to have many other factors that might be might dispose them to be pro-torture. For example, they might have political affiliations. They might be more conservative. They might be more Republican. Or they might be more loyal to President Bush.
Mm-hmm. Or might have been at one time.
But the point is that going to church, it's sort of like saying that, you know, if everybody, you know, it turns out that people who wear blue, you know, are more likely to be you know, human or something like that. It's like, I don't know. I mean, the point is that there are just too many factors there. What we would really need to look at to really get at this person's question is democratic evangelicals. That is to say, where do they fall on the torture question? Because that would kind of control for the more conservative the more Republican, the more loyal to President Bush person. Mm-hmm. If in fact we find that they are more pro-torture, then yeah, I would submit that would be something that your listeners should have reason to concern for. But right now, it's not clear to me that that's the case.
I also know, and I'm sure you do, that there are plenty of Christian and interfaith organizations that are mobilizing against torture, and also that there's been a real evolving discussion within evangelical Christianity about this.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think
that's fluid.
I think, absolutely. And and this is, I have never hesitated either way to speak before any audience on this matter. But I mean, I think it's certainly true. And this is, again, goes back to my point, is that knowing how anti-torture movements emerge historically leads me to conclude that our sort of normal presuppositions that conservatives are like this or Democrats are like this or religious people are like this and secular people are like this, these stereotypes, they don't work when it comes to torture.
Okay.
And
that's one
thing, that is very important to recognize. I mean, I guess there's one other thing I would say, though, is that, you know, as a society, well, actually, I'll pass on that. Maybe we'll come back to it in a different way.
I don't know. Do we have a hard stop? Okay. Well, I feel like it's a funny thing to say that we're talking about torture, but I feel like we could go on forever.
Well, we've got another half hour or so?
Well, I think we usually go about 90 minutes.
Okay.
This is great. It's going to be very hard to edit as it is. I do want to say I have a few places I want to go, and then maybe we can – if there are things you want to circle back to, we can do that.
Sure.
I don't know how this social scientific view you have of the human condition jives with what you learned from Shia Islam or Calvinist Christianity. But it does seem to me that there's an ironic upside to saying that most of us are capable of this given the right set of circumstances, that the upside is that if you create conditions, if you create the right conditions, most of us are not capable of this, is that it probably won't happen.
Right. I mean, exactly. That there is an upside is that you can actually – it's very easy to prevent torture with just clear rules, clear punishment, regular monitoring, regular remand before a judge in 24 hours. It is not – most people think that torture is like this impossible thing to prevent. It, certainly torture techniques can hide among children, among college kids and soldiers. But as an organized form, it's pretty easy to break it apart. And we did this once before in the 1930s. We cleaned up policing in the United States in the 1940s and 50s. And no matter how bad things are in police lockups today, they're nothing compared to what they were 100 years ago. So that part of it is good. And I think and that's the upside is that these things are within our control to change and within the control of governments and local counties and all sorts of people can make these changes happen. The other thing I guess I would say is that the reason I come to this is not so much because of my Shiite and Calvinist background, but because I understand that my family, I understand why people did what they did. I mean, I know that my relatives were cruel, but I also have seen their family lives, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that you can be an ordinary person and still do extraordinary things. The element that is somewhat lost in all this social science talk, though, is that, you know, we as social scientists, we can talk about the actual conditions that produce certain things. So we can say that evil happens or people do violent things, put in more neutral language. People do violent things because either they have a cognitive failure, that is to say they're held by some ideology or their brain doesn't quite work the way it should, or conversely that they are given incentives and that they're either paid to do it or they have a sort of – they're rigged to do it psychologically, let's say mothers being cruel to defend their children or something, whatever that particular version is. But the important thing is that what this doesn't capture and which religion does capture and literature on torture does capture is something that social scientists can't study, which is what about the person who just really delights in cruelty to others and what might be called indifferent cruelty. And that's not just something that emerges out of bureaucracy. That's a disposition, and it can't really be studied. I mean, the classic example of this is the devil, who is perfect cognitively and psychologically, and yet delights indifferently in the evil that happens. And this model is rooted in a lot of religious thought. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you read Dostoevsky on terrorism or Hannah Arendt on evil, on genocide. I mean, you get an inkling of this much deeper sort of ontological dislike of mm-hmm. human beings, of human life, and a kind of willingness to stand apart from it and do cruelty to it. And I don't think a social scientist can grasp that through the tools that he has.
Right. You know, as I prepared to speak with you and even as we've been talking, some of the things we're talking about, and we haven't gone into much detail at all of what you know about torture methods, and it's very, very chilling. And I just want to ask you to talk a little bit about how you keep your humanity intact. I mean, your book is not just a book. It's a massive tome on torture, right? I mean, that's so...
It's true.
How do you steep yourself in that and come back out of it?
Well, I would say that, first of all, the preface of my book kind of spells it out. In all the things I do, it's like 60% of my time is spent taking care of myself. I always know when I'm talking to someone who's a fellow walker on the dark side, because the first question we have for each other is, what do you do to keep your sanity? Mm-hmm. It's part of this vocation that you spend a lot of time focusing on you know, understanding yourself, understanding why you do what the things you do, and then kind of pulling yourself out of yourself and learning humility. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, I could give you a list of things I do. I surf, and I travel. These things pull me out of myself and get me focused on the beauty of the world. I mean, I think anybody who's studied as much as I have the dark side of human beings comes back with a kind of new eye at the things that we have, you know, sort of like a soldier mm-hmm. coming back to a clean bed after a war. Mm. There's a sense that you realize how valuable the peace is, you know, how my quiet little college where I teach at, and how, you know, how wonderful it is that these children don't know what's out there and aren't exposed to it and don't have this shaping their lives. So, I mean, I think I really come to appreciate the beauty of ordinary human interaction. I also, you know, I meditate. You know, and meditation can take many forms. I mean, in terms of exercise or when you're being beaten up by a 6-foot wave, you think, now there's humility. There's only so much I can actually change in the world. And you begin to understand that, you know, as an intellectual, there's only so much you can do. You can clarify things for people. You can provide information. You can show things. And then, you know, there are I guess what I would call spiritual practices. You know, there are things like I'm trying to think of one. It's kind of hard to think one on the spot. But there are certain things that I try to do, like when I'm working and I have this haunted feeling, that I step out of the house and I try not only to do routine things, but also try to do one good thing for someone in the course of the day that has nothing to do with me, you know, like think prospectively about others. These are all valuable things, but I will say undoubtedly the most important thing that helps me kind of focus is knowing your own story. Whoever's attracted to walking down the circles of Hades, there's no light in Hades. You have to know why you went in there. And the only thing that lights your way is your heart. And if you don't know what the story is that's taking you in there, you will get lost. It's a very disturbing place. It's very interesting to me that all the stories about people going into Hades are purposeful journeys. You know, there's a reason why someone goes. Orpheus goes down to find Eurydice, and on his way out, he has to be very careful because he can lose the insight that he gained on the way in. And that, I think, is not an uncommon experience. He does lose it because we do kind of get focused on the journey and not on the purpose. So my story is that, you know, is as you've heard it, I come from a certain background. I have a unusual gift. I can go into the dark side of things, and I could come back with a pretty good set of stories and insights to share with people, wisdom stories, if you
want. And also that you are a storyteller. I mean, that you come out of those dark places and are able to put words around them that other people can hear.
Right. And that, I think, is, yeah, the storytelling part is just being Iranian, and my love of stories is growing as a child. And that really has helped a lot in just being able to share, to take pain and transform it into a story of meaning. Whereas, you know, the thing that we all really – that disturbs all of us really is meaningless pain.
Right. And to talk even about – talking about meaning in the middle of this confrontation we're having with this recent history of torture, just even that idea is striking.
Well, yeah. But it's the reverse. The obverse would be much more terrible. I mean, violence pretty much forces a silence on people. When everyone sees a violent act, the first reaction they have to it is, well, it's bad and it should stop. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of where the brain ends. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of moral torture talk, if you want. But the ability to turn around and confront not the torture talk, which just simply become more familiar with your own moral sensibilities, mm-hmm. but to actually look at the practice, pay attention to it, understand its details, consider what would it take if I took a tool and I did this to such a person, what would its effects be? That's a pretty horrifying thing. Nobody really wants to go there. And yet to confront these sorts of practices, that is exactly what we need to do. I guess I have one other thing I would say. I guess part of what I'm trying to say is that being able to talk about it, developing a vocabulary so that you're not kind of stymied, and not a vocabulary that's just about your moral sensibilities, mm-hmm. what I would call our national debate, which you said is not a debate, and I agree, it's what I would call torture talk. Every society has a kind of economy of torture talk, and you know, ours is peculiar to our culture. But actually looking at these practices, developing a vocabulary, talking about them, that's where meaning and thought and reflection really become hard and hard to get, and when you can get them, hard to preserve. Hmm. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is, you know, going back, I don't know if the photographs will be released or where we will be in this process. Mm-hmm. But I also would like to say that the process by which we come to terms with our past doesn't necessarily have to involve a trial or a pinning of blame or going through all the wicked details and thinking through these questions. I think, frankly, and this is a rather, I guess, biblical way of saying this, but since you asked.
The Calvinist in you comes out after
that's
all.
That's right. That's right. I think whether you're Muslim or Christian or Jewish for that matter, I think you can start again. And you can start again not just by rehashing the past, which then creates a condition which we call political historicism, which is I tell the political history that way, you tell the political history that way, and then we spend all our lives fighting over who's got the right political history, right? We don't want to go there. The only way you can start over again is by asking for forgiveness, no matter where it was in the past, and you know, or apologizing, whatever you want to say, starting anew. And the Bible, actually, the ancients are actually much better at this than the moderns. You know, our modern conception of starting again is, well, we elect a new person,
right,
or we have a new policy, or we, you know, whatever that narrative is, mm-hmm. we move on, whatever that language is. And that's not what you get in the old political situations. If you really want to confront and repent about what you did, basically you kind of need two things. You need the whole nation to come together, or somebody on behalf of the whole nation, and not just to say, well, personally I find this abhorrent, but it happened on my watch and therefore whatever,
right.
I'm going to apologize. But what you want to have is, I, on behalf of the American people or whatever, people it is, I want to say that we are sorry about this. It reflects poorly on our values and so forth. But beyond that, it requires a new covenant. I mean, we know this from the Bible. It requires a promise not to do this again and to put into effect a series of steps that ensure that it will never happen again in the future. Mm-hmm. And here I think, you know, I look at the current political situation and I ask, why aren't we changing the Military Commissions Act so the definition of torture is back in conformity with international law?
Okay.
Why aren't we enforcing whistleblower laws or investigating how Army CID could have done a better job? Why aren't we putting a lot more money into acknowledging the trauma that we inflicted on our own soldiers so that people can understand what we did and what we asked of them was beyond what you should ask of any soldier? Why aren't we what would be another example? Oh, changing the Army Field Manual, which was changed during on interrogation, changing it back to the old standards. These are, I think, to my mind, fairly straightforward things that could be done legislatively, could have a part in making a new covenant with the world about where we are.
Hmm. That's probably your last word, but I wanted to say, I mean, you did just talk about this. I not only loved the last line of your book where you said, I mean, you end all of that with, where then, with you coming out of it, where then are my scotch, my accordion, my friends, and my surfboard? But I was also very taken with the dedication page you made to your teacher, your eighth grade geography teacher.
Jean Rosashi, yeah.
At community school in Tehran. And you wrote, he taught me that remembering how others live, knowing the proper names they give to places, people, and things, and being observant about how we live are basic skills for any life well lived. It's just beautiful.
Thank you. You know, as a scholar, I spend my whole life concentrating on things. And what Jean taught me was how to be attentive to people and to things. And that's a very different skill and one that I think as a scholar we tend to discount. Mm. But as somebody who works on violence and who has to regularly encounter the suffering of others, that was turned out to be one of the most important lessons I ever learned as a child.
Mm.
But thank you. Thank you. It was Jean died, as you know. I think it's in the
2004.
And he came out and saw me just before he died, and about a year before. And he wasn't going to see me, and he came to my house, and we went out and had lunch. And he kept on asking me about my work, and I never got to ask him about his stuff. And, you know, about what kind of teacher he was. I had all these questions I wanted to ask him, and I never could. And then what happened was that he wrote a letter after he met me to my old math teacher, Ed Rosenberg. And he said, I just saw Darius, and, you know, I feel really, you know, given the work that he's doing and how important it is, I feel really like I didn't, you know, I felt like I hadn't done anything important. and I was shocked because, you know, what I was trying to convey to him was how much he had actually meant to me. Mm. And so I felt like it was very, I struggled over that dedication. I thought of all the people I could name it for and so forth. And I realized that, no, the most important thing I wanted to capture was his gift of attentiveness, because I think that's one of such of the most fundamental skills that any human being can have.
Hmm. Is there anything you want to circle back to or say that we didn't get to?
I can't remember
we
what
have
I
two
said.
Minutes. Apparently we have 2 minutes. No, two questions. Oh, sorry. I have 2 questions from behind the glass.
All right.
So I'm going to be quiet for a minute and then I'll come back to you.
Yes. Hello?
Oh, yeah, I'm listening. Okay. I think I'm going to ask the last one, and just I think the other one we can maybe do online. Just the question that we, and now that we know this has happened, we still tend to think of this as done by people, even if they were Americans over there somewhere. But as you pointed out earlier, they come back home. And
yes.
Are we maybe adding to the questions you were posing a minute ago? I mean, are we setting up resources for helping them heal and make a transition back?
I would say that we are a little bit better than we were in Vietnam in terms of the knowledge we have of what it takes. But we are worse in terms of funding and support. The way in which we're better is that after Vietnam, we kind of left it to soldiers to come in and say, look, I have atrocity-related trauma, right. or I'm so forth. And the average time it took them to come in the doors was about 7 or 8 years, which I think is approximately, ironically enough, the average time it takes for a torture victim to walk in the doors of a torture rehabilitation facility in Denmark. Left to their own devices, people think that they can handle these issues. What we learned in Vietnam was that it's better always to responsibilize the families so that if your spouse or your parents or your children notice that you are behaving in ways that are not your characteristic behavior, to contact the appropriate people so that an intervention can happen, because we know that the earlier we can do an intervention, the better, and the more the prospect is of a healthy recovery. This is something that I think has been done a bit better with the psychologists in this war. On the other hand, I would say that the huge amount of pressure for military to serve in Iraq, the lack of funding sometimes for psychiatric support after a certain period of time, all these things, in tight economic times and with a war going on, these are give us incentives to discount the pain that the psychological trauma that soldiers bring with them. I mean, I don't want to trivialize the pain of victims. But I mean, torture is also terrible for the violators as well as the violated. So, and it's kind of difficult in the United States because we spend more time talking about what happens to our troops than what happens to the violated. But it's all pretty much the same: is that they both suffer on either side of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can do more in terms of services, and we have to really confront the fact that, as has always been the case with militaries going back at least as far as World War I, where it's the incentive of the state is often to create a two-class system where on the one hand people who have privileged backgrounds get good therapy and they can pay for it.
Right.
And people who are from not privileged backgrounds get the lousy 6-month treatment and then sometimes not even that and are told that they have to reenlist or they have to go back or whatever the particular version is.
Mm.
And that's been a problem with military health care going back a long ways.
Okay. Well, I've kept you a long time. I'm really glad to know about you and your work, and I hope maybe our paths will cross in person one day. So I'm glad you're out there doing that.
Well, thank you. And I hope I thank you for your questions. They were very sensitive and thoughtful.
Oh,
and,
good.
Yes, be in touch.
Okay.
I'll be around.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much. And we'll let you know exactly what this is happening and when it's going to be on the air. It'll be a few weeks, as I say.
Well, I'll be in Australia by then.
All right. Well, you can listen online. You can podcast
it. It's true.
Yeah.
Was there a question that you were going to send to me online as well? Or was that the only question?
No, the question was someone wanted to know more about Captain Fishbach, but I just think...
Yeah, it's a bit too more detailed. Yeah, and I can't remember too much right now.
Yeah, I think we can find other ways to explain that if it feels like it needs explanation.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.